So this is I plus delta, sometimes it's I and J, okay? And I write it that way to say that it's going to be nearest neighbor hopping, only in this case. Sigma is a spin. Sorry, I left out a sigma there. Yeah, so sigma is the spin. And the only reason why this is up down is because we're considering a single site. Okay, so the Coulomb repulsion is of course long range, but this is an approximation that hopefully captures the essence. Okay, that was the intent at the time. So what's left out? Long range, as I already mentioned, but what is also left out is that this is a single orbital theory. Okay, and for example, as far as ferromagnetism is concerned, this model failed, basically. And the sort of folklore belief in the present day is that what is needed to properly describe ferromagnetism is multiple orbitals. Okay, you can't just fixate on the one orbital near that you think is near the Fermi surface. You need to consider more than one orbital. So I introduced a two-site model, and then there were these 16 basis states, which meant you had a 16 by 16 matrix. If you wanted to do three sites, you'd have 64 by 64. Four sites is 256 by 256, and you can see this thing grows exponentially. But it's not entirely hopeless, because you can block diagonalize, as this is referred to, because you can identify quantum numbers, good quantities that are conserved first. So we mentioned electron number is conserved by this Hamiltonian. So this is the zero electron sector. This is the four electron sector. You don't have to consider them simultaneously. You can consider them completely separately. Down here is the two electron sector. But even there, when you look at this model, the SZ component is conserved. So there were various states here, some of which had SZ equals 1, and some of which had SZ equals minus 1, and four of which had SZ equals 0. And you could go further, as I said, you could consider S. Total S is a good quantum number. That's more difficult to take advantage of in this circumstance. But what you could do right away is Fourier transform this to a wave vector space, and then this becomes the kinetic energy term that you're already familiar with, plus the Hubbard term, becomes essentially that. And again, if you simply look at the wave vector indices, when you destroy wave vector k, you create it back. So that's conserved. You destroy k prime, but then you also destroy minus k prime, and you destroy q, but then you create back q, you create back minus k, but you also create back k. So overall, you create no wave vector, zero wave vector. So when you do that, for example, what I've tried to indicate schematically is a 4x4, we'll put a 1x1 and a 1x1 there, becomes two 2x2 matrices that are completely decoupled. And so at the end, you have to diagonalize a two-dimensional matrix. So in that NE equals 2 SZ equals 0 sector, you get four eigenvalues, which are these. And one thing, so that tells you very little. You'd like to see the eigenvector, so let me write those down. So the eigenvector for this is 1 over root 2. So the notation in the notes is, remember, last class I told you, you needed a certain convention of site 1, site 2, and spin up, spin down, and I mentioned it yesterday. I think the notation in the notes is actually slightly different from what I said yesterday, but it doesn't matter. You know, if you, one of you writes your own program to do this, you don't necessarily use my convention. You use the opposite convention if you like, but you get the same answer. This one is 1 over root 2, C1 up dagger, C1 down dagger, 0 minus C2 up, C2 down dagger. And then these ones are more complicated. These ones are, I'll call them UK over root 2 times C1 up dagger, C2 down dagger, minus C1 down dagger, C2 up dagger. Plus VK over root 2. And this one is C1 up dagger, C1 down dagger, plus C2 up dagger, C2 down dagger. And this one is VK over 2. With the same state, minus UK over root 2 with the same state. And UK squared, VK squared is 1/2 times 1 plus or minus U over 2. U over 2 squared. So one thing that carries on more generally when you do many more systems, by the way, you can get up to about 16 sites this way. And that's the limit. And you can still learn a lot. And these are used to benchmark a lot of results that are not exact. If you just look at these eigenvalues, yes. Yeah. Yeah. For the ground state. Okay. It's one thing to compute numerically the entire spectrum and get all the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. But if you're after the low line states, the ground state in particular, there are algorithms that allow you to diagonalize matrices that are several million by several million. Okay, so what I want to point out here, just look at the so again, we look at these two forms of the Hamiltonian, and what should be clear, I hope, at least when I do a quick example as well, is when it's written in real space, this term is diagonal. What does it mean to say it's diagonal? It means that when this operates on a state in real space, nothing happens. It counts. right? It tells you how many of those sites in that state are doubly occupied. But then it returns back the state. It doesn't change it. This state changes it. Or this part of the Hamiltonian changes it. When you write the Hamiltonian in wave vector space, and then see these states here, these states are enumerated according to their real space sites. If I write the Hamiltonian in wave vector space and solve the problem in that space, I enumerate states according to their wave vector, not according to their site. And there are 16 of those as well. This Hamiltonian is such that the kinetic energy is diagonal. It doesn't change the state. It just counts and then returns back the state. Whereas the potential energy term does change the state. So you've got the two sort of limits, one which is exact in this limit that if U is really, really large, and one that is exact in the limit where the U is small and the kinetic energy dominates. So that's how you kind of use real space and wave vector space. When U is really large, you notice that two of these have energy that go to U. And two of them have energy that go to zero. Okay, so you get a set of states now that are split by U. Okay, remember the picture according to the kinetic energy term here was this band, and it went from 2t minus 2t to 2t in energy. So this is k, this is energy. And of course, we're only dealing with two states in this band, these two, which you can't tell from here, but it's k equals 0 and k equals pi. So the splitting here is 4t. And now we introduce the U, and you imagine that these states move up and down a bit. But in the extreme that U is really, really large, they don't just move down a bit. There are states now that are way up at U and states that stay at zero. Okay, and the interpretation of the ones that stay at U, if you look at these states, so this one is the easiest to see because the basis states here are both double occupied states. They consist of the two electrons either being on site one, or the two electrons being on site two. So it makes sense that all you're doing is paying a price U, and that's the energy associated with these two states. It's less obvious that the kinetic energy plays no role in these states. Down here is another state that as U goes to infinity, this goes to U. It's not precisely U like this one. And you see it's a linear combination of states that have single occupation and states that are doubly occupied. But their prefactors here are UK and VK. And as U goes to, let's see. As U goes to infinity, yeah, we're looking at this one. As U goes to infinity, the UK goes to 1, and the VK goes to 0. So as U goes to infinity for this state, this U goes to 1, this VK goes to 0. And so this part of the wave function is what remains, and that's the doubly occupied portion of the wave function. This portion of the wave function is singly occupied. So you have this concept of states that involve double occupation and states that do not involve double occupation. And there's a whole procedure for taking advantage of that. If you have fewer, let's suppose you have less than half filling, which for a mini lattice site system, mini site system, means that on average, you know, here's a 16 site lattice, so we're talking about less than 16 electrons. There's particle hole symmetry in this model, which means that the case of more than 16 electrons is completely understood once you understand the case of less than 16 electrons. But for less than 16 electrons, you can have you know, a huge number of states here, but a bunch of those states will only involve single occupation. And if U is large, those are the states that are going to contribute to the ground state energy or the ground state configuration. Any double occupied state will raise the energy considerably. So that leads us to a very simple variational calculation that involves two states. One state you know, which is the Fermi C. What's the Fermi C in this notation? It's a product of electrons. So now we're going to consider a bulk system. We're back to 10 to the 23rd states. It's a product of spin up, spin down electrons occupied, and the ones that are occupied are those whose energies are less than EF. So this is that simple picture where you've got a Fermi sphere, and those are all the occupied states. And there's just going to be this huge product of those states. So those are occupied, everything outside is unoccupied. And you recognize that as the answer to the second, the way the Hamiltonian is written in the second line, when we ignore the U completely. Because the problem is solvable then, just free electrons with a dispersion epsilon k. What is the other candidate state? The other candidate state is what I would call an insulating state, which is pi I equals 1 to Ne of Ti and sigma I dagger acting on 0. So what is that? That is a state that for example, if we've got an infinite lattice and I've got, I don't know, what's that? Eight electrons on that lattice. So I go up to the number of electrons I have and I'm considering Ne less than or equal to N, which where N is number of lattice sites, and Ne is the number of electrons. Then notice I don't have a product here of two creation operators at the same site I. So the only thing that enters here are states that have only single occupation. And then I claim they don't move. This is a variational state, right? I can make up whatever I like. And if they don't move, then we look at the Hamiltonian at the top, on the top line, and the first term doesn't enter because they don't move. And the second term gives zero because there are no doubly occupied sites by design. That's how I've designed this insulating state. And for example, you can imagine when the number of electrons equals the number of sites. So So in this case, I've got something like that, and then everything just stays put. I mean, imagine that U up there is 100 times T. Why would it hop? If this hops there, then it would pay a huge price because of that U. So, and as we mentioned last time, if you do this problem properly, you derive the Heisenberg model as an effective model for that Hubbard model, and then you would actually alternate these spins closer to the ground state. But for now, we have the spins. There's a huge degeneracy. We don't care about what the spins are. So everybody understand the state? It's just an insulating state. It stays put, and that's it. Okay, so it's a contest between these two states. What's the energy of this state? Zero. Yeah, so we want to compute, when we do a variational calculation, we want to calculate that expectation value, which is the expectation value of the energy, and normalize it if they're not normalized, and that is zero in this case. What is the energy of this state? Okay, that's a lot harder calculation. You have to, I mean, it's not that hard, but you have to put in the second form of the Hamiltonian and actually evaluate these matrix elements. So if you do that for the hopping part of the Hamiltonian, let me just tell you what you get. So that one's, the hopping part of the Hamiltonian is easy. And you get, where is it here? Minus T over 2. No, sorry. Minus 2T. N times 2 minus N. Okay, and to calculate this, I'm going to assume two dimensions. And I've actually assume that the density of states is a constant, okay, which is not true for the tight binding model in two dimensions with nearest neighbor hopping. It's got that logarithmic singularity, but it's a good enough approximation, okay, that it's constant. Then you can evaluate and get that. The algebra is in the notes, and you can look at them after. And then if you calculate what this is, you get U over 4 N squared. So that the FHF is 2NT times N 1 plus U over 8T minus 2. And now you plot those energies as a function of U, say. So this guy is easy. It's just this. So that's the insulating state. So these are energies. And then the other one, which is this one, will be some kind of straight line as a function of U, because U comes in there linearly. And it depends on N. For N is equal to 1, then this is 8t, for example. So what does this tell you? This tells you that as long as u is less than 8t, that this will be metallic. N is, yeah, sorry, thank you. N is the electron density. Lowercase n is the electron density. So it'll vary between 0 and 1 now. On the other hand, if u is greater than 8t, then this will be an insulator. So just this quick and dirty calculation based on some trial wave functions, which we know are wrong, but which epitomize the metallic state versus the insulating state, we get this metal insulator transition. Okay, at some point, this thing will become insulating when u is too large. And the criterion, again, within this model, is when u over 8t exceeds 2 divided by n minus 1. So it's a function of the density. If there are very few electrons in the system, then u has to be really large, because they can happily roam around. If you've got 10 to the 23rd sites in which to hop to and from, and there's only 5 of you, who cares what u is? You're going to be happily in this Fermi type of state where you indeed have lowered the energy by forming that band. Remember, that band used to be a line at 0, and all those states below 0 have been lowered due to kinetic energy alone in this figure. So that makes sense. When you get really crowded, which is n is equal to 1, then you get this transition at 8t, which is amazingly accurate given the sort of state-of-the-art calculations that have been done up to date. Okay, and anything else I want to say? Yeah, let me just add that, remember, go back to one of the first lectures in the course when we did the chronic penny model, and we discovered that bands were formed. And we got this set of bands that went up in energy, and they had these gaps, right? And I told you, if the Fermi energy lay in one of these gaps, then we had an insulating state. Whereas if the Fermi energy was in one of the bands, then we had a metallic state, because there were states that were empty that were readily accessible, that if you applied a field, you'd get movement of the electrons. Whereas here, if you applied a small field, you didn't have. So this is the basis for classifying materials as being either metallic or insulating. And there are cases here where these would be referred to as band insulators, because this notion of these being insulators comes entirely from a band picture. When we talked about this, we hadn't even introduced interactions. There was no U. It was just plain and simple from consideration of bands. This, on the other hand, is referred to as a Mott insulator, or Mott-Hubbert insulator, named after two of the people that first formulated these ideas. And this results from correlations. This is due to interactions. This has nothing to do with the band anymore. It's completely due to interactions. And we could give an entire course on that development. Is there anything else I want to say? I guess I don't know if some of you have heard of the TJ model. I was going to talk about it, but then I've clearly run out of time, and it would take an entire lecture. The TJ model is something that became very popular in the last 20 years, and it results from projecting out of this Hubbard model all the doubly occupied states. So because in a strongly correlated system, by definition, it means U is large. That's what really is meant by a strongly correlated system. The interactions are big compared to the kinetic energy. Then you believe that the states that cost you a lot in energy, namely the doubly occupied states, don't participate in the ground state, for example. Why would they? That would cost a lot of energy. And so why work with a Hamiltonian and do a lot of work when that requires you to consider those states alongside these states, these kinds of states? And so there's a procedure for projecting those out, and that's called a TJ model that results. And what it means is that you now consider something like that model, but the kinetic energy is such that you always avoid double occupancy. So the electrons move around while avoiding one another. And if that's in there from the beginning, that means you've already treated some part of the correlations right from the start, and your results will be more authentic. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about the Hubbard model. So I'm going to move on to superconductivity now. And before I do, are there any questions concerning this or any related topics? Okay. If not, we'll move on to superconductivity. So, actually, could I have the screen, please? And because I'm going to show some slides. So I've touched on this before, but I'm going to just talk a little bit about the history and the key experiments. Oh, am I connected to the internet here? Looks like I am. Okay, so I've mentioned these guys before, Kamerling Ohms and Gilles Holst, who discovered superconductivity in 1911. So this is the famous picture. This is temperature down here, and instead of this thing coming down towards absolute zero and either diverging or going right to zero, it plummeted and gave you this phase transition. So number one for superconductivity is zero resistance. And as soon as you see zero resistance, if you're at all thinking about applications, you get very excited.
What temperature is that?
It's 4.18 degrees or something like that. This one is 4.4 or something. But the Kelvin, yeah.
How did they achieve low
Liquid helium.
Liquid helium, I guess.
Kamerlingh Owens is famous. 1908, he's the one who first liquefied helium. There was this huge race for doing that. And then once you got there, Leiden was basically the only place that could do it for years. And so then you can access these temperatures and do all sorts of wonderful things.
How do you liquefy?
Pardon?
How? Yeah. Using pressure?
Yes, there is pressure involved. You're asking very experimental questions. There's a dilution refrigerator used now, but that's not what he had. So he had, what did he have? There is pressure involved because you pump on it. I know that, but I don't know all the details. Okay, so number one is resistivity, but number two is the Meissner-Rosenfeld effect. Okay, and we really have to distinguish between a superconductor and a perfect conductor, and that's what this experiment did. Okay, a superconductor has flux expulsion. Okay, and that's key, as opposed to flux exclusion. Flux exclusion is Lenz's law. So let me, I was looking, you know, this picture shows a levitating magnet, but you can't look at that and say, ah, a superconductor. Okay, so let me explain. I hope this is connected, because I just had a quick look on the internet before I came and was amused to find...
like when the demo is done, typically it's with a superconductor. Superconductor.
Don't give it away though if you know the answer. Oh, well. So when you Google, what did I Google? Meissner effect in a superconductor or something. This is the number one hit you get. You get this video, and I'm starting it partway through because it's kind of boring. But here is, and it's silent. I don't know why it's silent. Okay, so look what they do. They cool down the sample. The sample is in that white thing, and now they're floating this magnet above the superconducting sample. Okay, this is not the Meissner effect, right? This is Lenz's law. This is that Lenz's law would prevent that magnet from coming down on a perfect conductor. That's just Lenz's law in action.
But you do need a superconductor.
But let me show you.
It's not in my book.
Let me show you.
What? You showed it.
Okay, but for both effects, you need
superconductor. No. Oh, for perfect.
Okay, so here is the Meissner effect. This thing, the magnet is sitting on the superconductor, and now they're cooling the superconductor down. You don't see much here, but it's gonna. Yeah, so it's still sitting there. There's sound for this, but I guess it's not playing. That's okay. Doesn't matter. And yeah, I think it's already popped up, although it's not so apparent. So the guy's going to come in with tweezers and try and demonstrate this, and he'll knock it off accidentally, and then he'll put it back, and then one of the kids goes, "Wow!" But we don't hear that. That part where it popped up, that is the Meissner effect. That means that the flux is being expelled, not just excluded. Okay, so flux expulsion is what superconductivity is all about, as opposed to perfect conductivity. Yes?
I think you might have already told me this, but what would be an example of a material that is a perfect conductor but not a superconductor?
We don't have any.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't have any examples, but we understand the concept.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so, and you know, poor old Kamerlingh Onnes, he liquefied helium in 1908, and they didn't get around to the experiment till 1911. And they used mercury. They used mercury because mercury is a liquid metal, right? And why is that important? Because Kamerlingh Onnes thought he was testing this notion of what was going to happen at zero temperature. And we haven't discussed it in this course, but if you plot resistivity as a function of temperature, for metal, it comes down, and then it sort of saturates. What is that saturation resistivity due to? It's due to the fact that every material is full of garbage. It's got impurities. It's got all sorts of things. So what do? You make the metal cleaner and cleaner, and then this thing comes down, and you get this residual resistance at zero temperature that gets lower and lower and lower. And so Kamerlingh Onnes chose mercury because through a distillation process, because it's a liquid, he could continually purify this thing to get it to be very pure, because he thought he was going after a perfect conductor. And so you can try and achieve that, but it's not been achieved.
So I have a quick question. Did Kamerlingh Onnes discover superconductivity by chance, or he was expecting something like that?
Oh, it was by chance.
By
I mean, as far, I mean, he was expecting, so I don't know if I discussed it in the first lecture, because I, so as a function of temperature, okay, with mercury, it's coming down. He was expecting one of two things. He was expecting this, or he was expecting this. That it would diverge at zero temperature. This was what Kelvin had hypothesized, which is in modern day language, this is the Wigner crystallization. So there were two possibilities that you know, the electrons you would freeze out all impediments to electrons. So these, mainly the vibrations, right? I mean, there was some notion that there were these, that the atoms would be jiggling around and would interfere with the motion of the electron. The thing you could not get rid of through temperature were the impurities, just sort of impurities lying around. You have to get rid of those in the material, in the sample preparation, and that's why he was doing this distillation. So he was expecting something to happen down at zero temperature, and now that he could cool down much lower with the liquid helium, he was excited about doing that. He did not expect this sort of abrupt decrease. Okay. So back to the history. So this was very important because this also, this discovery of the Meissner effect, and it didn't happen until 1933, right? So many years after finding zero resistance, you found the Meissner effect. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is, because it also tells you it's thermodynamic. If it were the situation of Lenz's law in action, then how you achieve a particular state, or achieving a particular state, would depend on the history. It would depend on whether you cooled first or whether you applied a field first. And as soon as it depends on history like that, we have much less chance of understanding what's going on. With the Meissner effect, it was clear it didn't depend on history. And that meant it was thermodynamic, and you could sort of tackle it with many of the methods we knew about at the time. Okay, what else happened between 1933 and the modern era? So these are just running through some of the important players. There were London brothers, and actually they've written two books, both on one on superconductivity and one on superfluidity, because they did a lot of work in helium 4 in particular. And I would say their key contribution, and this is sort of documented in Bardeen's writings about what inspired him to look for the BCS state, is what I would call, my advisor called them quantum cows. So this is some kind of rigidity in the superconducting state. Okay, in a regular conductor, or a perfect conductor for that matter, the expectation is that the electrons just move through the solid as individuals. Because after all, if there were no impurities, Bloch's theorem already tells you that there are these extended states, and although we didn't do the calculation, if you calculated the conductivity for a Bloch state, you'd get infinite conductivity. Okay, there's nothing stopping a Bloch state. The reason why Bloch states don't give you infinite conductivity in practice is because you have surfaces, you have impurities, you have phonons at finite temperature, you've got all sorts of things interfering with it. This said, however, London's idea was that there was some kind of rigidity, that it's as if all the electrons were connected in some massive state, right? Which is new. It means that there's a strong correlation amongst these electrons, and you can't just imagine them to be independent. The next guy around 1935 is Chubnikov. I didn't know about this guy when I was studying superconductivity in graduate school. He was executed in the late 30s, I think, by Stalin or Stalin's regime. So we heard very little about him. But he had discovered what is known as type 2 superconductivity. So I'm going to explain type 1 and type 2 superconductivity. But he had done this back in the 1930s, which is pretty impressive. Then is Ginzburg and Landau, whom I'm sure all of you have heard about. In 1950, and I'll give maybe a brief example of what they did, but they formulated the Ginzburg-Landau theory of phase transition. So it's a very general framework in which we can understand phase transitions, including superconductivity, and based on symmetry breaking, based on very, very global ideas. So it's a phenomenology, but it leads to a lot of insights into what is going on. Abrikosov was one of Landau's students, and in fact, his story is interesting because, again, with these type 2 superconductors, I better tell you what they are now. So you saw that levitating magnet, that was above a cuprate superconductor that has a critical temperature of about 90 degrees, so that's YBCO. That is a type 2 superconductor. The flux, the demonstration you saw is a little bit misleading because in the superconductor, you do not have a perfect Meissner state. So the perfect Meissner state, if you plot magnetization versus H, a perfect Meissner state would give you this minus 1 over 4 pi, which results in B being 0. So that's what's considered a perfect Meissner state. And then at some critical field, that collapses, and then you you go back to the normal state. So what does this mean? This means that all magnetic field is expelled. What Chubnikov had found is that for many materials, many superconducting materials, this is not true. That the magnetization, it looks a lot more complicated, and there is, yes, there is a perfect Meissner state, but only for a short while, and then, so up to a critical field of about HC1, and then for much larger fields, up to HC2, there is partial flux penetration. So in this state, if I have a sample like this, then there's complete flux exclusion. Okay, if that's a superconducting sample, and you try to put a magnetic field through it, it's completely excluded. So this is this one. In this state, it's not completely excluded. There are these flux lines that come through. I mean, there'll be some exclusion as well, but these flux lines come through these so-called vortices. Okay, so you have this is what is referred to as type 2 superconductivity. And why do some, actually most superconductors are type 2? Why? Because actually Ginzburg-Landau did a calculation of the surface energy, and sometimes the surface energy is negative, sometimes it's positive. If it's negative, then you're encouraged to have regions of normal, of the normal state where the flux lines can penetrate alongside regions of the superconducting state.
Vortices interact between each other?
No, vortices.
The lines, the vortices.
Yes.
They interact between each other?
Yes, they do. Yes. And that, and in fact, that's what Abrikosov did. He did a calculation in 1952. And his supervisor said, this is garbage, throw it away. So he had it in a drawer for 4 years. So don't necessarily listen to your supervisor, even if he is Landau, right? So it actually sat in his desk, literally, for about 4 years. And then it was eventually published in 1956. And that's what he won the Nobel Prize for, eventually. So, As Juan asked about interactions, the answer is yes, and that's what Abrikosov did, was calculate that these form a lattice. Okay, so they won't just be randomly in there. Now, there's more to it than that, because, I mean, suppose you've got a really big defect in your superconductor. And that's one of the big deals about this, as opposed to a perfect conductor, right? The superconductor can be really dirty, really a mess, not a great material whatsoever, and still superconductor. Whereas a perfect conductor, you better get everything just right and better get everything clean. If you've got junk lying around, that's going to be a sensible place to put a vortex, because it's near the junk, the sample isn't really going to be superconducting, so it's not costing you a lot of energy to penetrate there. But barring any of that, you will get a lattice of these vortices, and because of interactions. Actually, he calculated a square lattice. He made a small mistake, and it was corrected later on, and it's a triangular lattice for this one. Although, much later on, there were these materials, these borocarbides, some of which have square lattices too, because the energies are very close. Okay, and then this is my favorite, is Brian Josephson. So what Josephson did, I it's one of those things I would never be able to do, because even if I discovered what he discovered, I would not believe it, and I would throw it away, and that would be it. He was a young student. He had Phil Anderson, whom you've heard about before already, he had him fortunately visiting Cambridge. So, and Phil Anderson encouraged him on. I mean, I'm not sure a student would have pursued this. But what Josephson did was discovered Josephson currents, which is and Josephson junctions, which is the phenomenon that that even in the absence of an applied voltage, current will flow through a tunneling barrier, through a weak link between two superconductors. Simply for the reason that the two superconductors possess slightly different properties is something we can't even really see, which is their phase. Okay, so he basically took the Hamiltonian quite literally and found that there was this term. So by then, I'm jumping back and forth, but by then, tunneling had been discovered, right? In 1959, I think, by forgotten his Izaki. And then Jivor discovered superconducting tunneling in 1960. So this was single particle tunneling. You take an electron and you pass it through a you form a junction. So this is some oxide layer. This is a metal or a superconductor, and this is a superconductor. And then you put leads on this, and you try to tunnel through this barrier, and you learn, or this way, and you learn something about the superconductor that way. If these were both metals, and you did this experiment, you would get kind of Ohm's law, right? Because you'd measure I versus V, and you'd see linear behavior. But in a superconductor, as we'll see, you get something different. But that was all understood by 1962. But Josephson said, no, wait a minute, there's more to it than that. There's a possibility that a Cooper pair, will tunnel across, and that this actually occurs in the absence of, it'll tunnel across if you've got superconducting. And it'll occur in the absence of an applied voltage because of the phase difference between these two superconductors. And the phase is something that comes about in the superconducting state. So it's incredible, because this is most of you are interested in theory, and this is one of those examples. Well, so is Abrakosov in a way, but it's one of those examples where the theory not only preempted the experiment, but actually it didn't preempt the experiment. So if you go back to 1932, okay, it's in German, but there are signs of this Josephson current already in 1932. In 1952, this woman who had worked with Meissner actually published this paper where she stated that she had observed that the resistance disappears, even again in the absence of an applied voltage. But nobody knew what to think of it. In 1960, is this? Yeah. 1960, this is an IV characteristic like what I drew here, but it's on it, it's V versus I. So they saw, so V is zero here. And when it's zero, you get this current. And they basically saw this and said, well, this is just means we've got a leak. We've got something wrong with the junction, and we're not going to worry about it. Jivor, who won the Nobel Prize for single particle tunneling in 1960, so this is the paper that got him the Nobel Prize, he also noticed, okay, it's sort of disguised down here, but that he got a current sometimes at zero voltage. That's this thing here, and then it goes across. He got a current at zero voltage. And he said also, as is apparent from the low current behavior of this sample, the oxide film is pierced by a superconductive bridge. So we've got a leak. We've got some defect in the junction. There's a path through here, from this side to this side without it having to tunnel through this barrier. That's what he concluded. He was actually seeing Joseph Sinkern. All these guys were seeing Joseph Sinkern. But no one could imagine that such a thing existed. So that was a huge contribution by Brian Josephson. And of course, I skipped in between 1957, and that's what we're going to discuss mostly in the remainder of this course, was the so-called BCS theory. And as I mentioned before, Bardeen, so this was published in 1957. In the late fall of 1956, he had to go to Stockholm to get his Nobel Prize for the transistor, and that he shared with Shockley and Bratton. And then later on, these guys shared the Nobel Prize, I think in 1972. He was the senior guy, obviously well-known at the time and stuff. Cooper was a postdoc, and Schrieffer was a PhD student. In fact, the number of times that PhD students come up in superconductivity is incredible. He certainly was a student at the time, and so was Abrikosov, at least in 1952. And then in 1986 was this big breakthrough, because we discovered superconductivity at higher temperatures. Bednors and Mueller found superconductivity in 30 degrees Kelvin. They had this very tentative title called possible superconductivity, because as you can see, it doesn't come down to zero till about 10 degrees. But the fact that it started up around 30 is what got everybody excited. For several decades before this, the record was down at about 23 degrees Kelvin. And then I should put Paul Chu up here too, who just a couple of months later upped that to 90 degrees. This is a so I did a postdoc in San Diego, UCSD, and that's where Brian Maple's group is, who does lots of experiments. And my supervisor and I decided to take a sabbatical break for 2 days, and we made samples ourselves. So this is a theorist sample, and we measured the resistivity. And actually, we had a little competition to see whose transition was sharpest. So it's really exciting for a guy like me, like a theorist, to actually just make some of this stuff and measure it and see it with your own eye. Even to the point you learn, you know, you see the data points up top and then down here, and there's actually a shift in slope, right? And that's because we slowed down the measurement process. Up there, we were trying to hurry it up. And what's obvious from that slight shift is that when you go that fast, you don't give enough time for the sample to equilibrate, to have uniform temperature. So you just learn things about the whole process that are kind of neat. They're good to know. Even attaching the leads to the sample was an interesting chore. Okay, so I've already mentioned the critical fields, and I'm going to, let me see, what have we got? I don't know, this is a bit premature, but since I have this up here, I'm going to talk about some of the experiments that any theory now would want to explain. This is done after BCS theory, but this is particularly good data, and some of it existed before the theory. They knew that there was some kind of jump at TC. Okay, so this is the normal state. It ends right here. You get these data points, how? By applying a magnetic field. If you apply a sufficiently high magnetic field so that you go beyond HC, aluminum is type 1, so it's one of these superconductors. If you go beyond HC, then you make the material normal, and you hope you haven't altered the specific heat, the electronic specific heat. This requires extracting the phonon contribution and just looking at the electronic contribution. And you can test that by doing data up here in field and without the field, and you see there's not much dependence on field. So that gives you a handle on the normal state specific heat below the critical temperature, and then you measure the superconducting one in the absence of a field, and there's a huge dramatic effect. You get this big jump. Okay. And again, there's a whole thing about phase transitions, and that could be a divergence, but in this case, it's the jump. You also see that down at low temperatures, that it's very activated form of specific heat. It looks like it's exponentially decreasing. And that's also important. That was indicative that some kind of gap in the spectrum was at work. So that's one of the things. And there's actually the BCS theory. So you can see it's not that far. This is the Gibbs free energy is basically this hc squared over 8 pi. And so this is a measure as a function of temperature of what the Gibbs free energy ought to look like for a type 1 superconductor. And then these are results, experimental results of this HC2, the supercritical field. And they don't show it here. What is striking is the scale. Okay, this is in Tesla. Okay, it's not shown on here, but type 1 superconductors, certainly aluminum, but even some of the better type 1 superconductors, their critical field curves are way, way down here. Okay, they're under 1 Tesla. Why is that important? Because one of the places where these things have been used for decades now is in MRI magnets in hospitals. So they actually use superconducting electromagnets. They have to run large currents so that they can generate these big magnetic fields. But if a magnetic field is going to destroy superconductivity, then you can't use such a superconductor. So not only do you want high critical temperatures, you actually, more importantly, want high critical fields. And that's where the type 2 superconductors have a lot of practical use, because they sustain these huge magnetic fields. These tens of Tesla is a huge field. Your garden variety magnet, not your garden variety, your best magnets that you can purchase for your lab, I don't think they exceed around 18 Tesla. Okay, and if you go to magnet labs where they do pulsed magnetic fields, you can get up in that regime, but that's a completely different story. Okay, and this is the I should have had this earlier. This is the single particle tunneling. So I'll come back to this because it's got data, but it doesn't illustrate that junction. So you start with something like that junction, and it shows you the two parts. So inside here is like an oxide layer. You tunnel from one side to the other, and if both sides have metals, you've got the figure at the top. What's pictured there is a Fermi C. So they're just showing you a lot of axes here. But going up is energy. That dashed line across the top is the Fermi level. I wonder if we've got a point here.
The USB has to be taken out of it for it to work.
And I got to plug it in. Actually, maybe I'll use the. Does my mouse work here? Yeah. So the dashed line is up here. That's the Fermi level. So these are Fermi Cs at finite temperature, hence you've got this little bit of smearing. And what do you expect in such a situation? Well, the guys that are spilled over here above the Fermi level can tunnel over to the empty states over here above the Fermi level. And anyways, you get some tunneling current, and there's this oxide layer serves as a resistance, so you just get Ohm's law. And that's what's shown here. In a superconductor, as we'll discover, there is this gap. And so even though you've got a metal over here, you can't tunnel from these states into these ones, because there are no states here. The states only start after this gap. And so you get a region of no tunneling current whatsoever down here. And that's what you expect. And for superconducting junction, it's actually quite complicated, both at finite temperature and zero temperature. So I won't dwell on that. But when you carry out these measurements and you measure this gap as a function of temperature, you're going to get results as shown here by the data, and that's going to be overlaid with BCS theory. So keep this in mind. This is what we'll look at, probably not tomorrow, but on the last day we'll see some of the theoretical results. Okay. So if I can have the screen up, please. So, I've got in the notes a short calculation using Ginzburg-Landau theory that gives you an illustration of what happens at a surface, and that's the basis for calculating the surface energy. But I'm going to skip over that. It's there for you in the notes if you desire, just because of time. What I want to now address before we get to BCS theory is the notion of mechanism. With the idea that the electrons form some kind of condensate, people in the 50s were already looking for a way to explain how electrons would bind in some condensate. So they're looking for some mechanism of attraction. And that's what I mean by mechanism. So people use the phrase BCS theory to mean several things. I use it to describe the formalism that we're going to get to next class. Some people also tie it in with mechanism, which is what BCS modeled in their big 1957 paper was the electron phonon induced attraction. And that's what I want to quickly run through in the time we have remaining here. So this was done by both Froelich and Bardeen and Pines in the early 1950s, 1950, 1952. So they were both using basically the Froelich Hamiltonian, which had these three pieces. They had kinetic energy, they had phonons, and they had the electron-phonon interaction. So we've been exposed to this when we talked about the polaron. And for the Froelich interaction, this M of Q had some specific Q dependence. But for the Holstein model, for example, this was G times omega E. And it's probably simpler to just keep that in mind. For purposes here. So what both these guys sought was a canonical transformation. Right, given by this S. So S is a unitary operator. And if you have H psi equals E psi, and then you substitute H in here, you get E to the S H tilde, E to the minus S psi is equal to E psi. And so if you bring this over, preserving all the commutation relations, and then wrote this as psi, then this implies a similar, a Schrodinger equation. And why do you do this? Because if you make the right transformation, this is done. It's diagonal and it's solved. Of course, that's impossible to do in almost all circumstances. But what you want to do is make a transformation that makes this a lot easier to solve or more enlightening to solve, or to say it another way, that maybe this unitary transformation already has a lot of the physics in it, so what will come out of this will be more transparent. Okay, and the basic idea or the strategy here is the following, that if I take that quantity and write this out and realize that H has got a sort of a zeroth order piece, which in this case would be the electron kinetic energy and the phonon diagonal piece. If it's got that plus sort of a perturbation, then, which is the electron-phonon interaction in this case, then this can be written as H-naught in general, it's written as H plus H commutator S plus 1/2 H commutator S, and so on, right? There's this infinite series. But if you can separate out H into H naught plus H1, then you can furthermore write this as H naught plus H1 plus H naught times S, or commutator S, plus 1/2 times the remaining piece here. And if you can, so this is of order S, and this is sort of a perturbation, this is of order 1. So if you could choose S to eliminate this, so you choose S so that this disappears, then this is of order S squared. Then you've eliminated, through this transformation, the first order contribution. And the hope is that then you're that much further towards the solution. That's the strategy. So you want H naught S plus H1 equal to 0. Okay, at the operator level. Now, what do you choose for S? Well, if you stare at H1, you could try the following. Okay, so it looks very much like H1, except there are these coefficients, alpha. So these are operators, the A and A dagger are operators, but these alpha QK and beta QK are simply coefficients that you don't know. So what you've postulated is that it has this form, and now you plug that into here and try and determine alpha QK and beta QK such that that's true. So that's all worked out in the notes. And let me skip everything. And you'll find that alpha QK is minus 1 over root N times 1 over epsilon K plus Q minus epsilon K plus H bar omega Q. And beta QK is equal to something similar, but with a minus sign there. So plus or minus, depending on whether it's alpha or beta. So that determines your transformation such that this is zero. And now you can simply go back and rewrite the Hamiltonian, at least to second order. So again, that's a bit of a chore. So let me run right to the end, and you will get H is equal to H naught. So H naught remains, the two pieces, plus 1 over N, sum over K, K prime, Q, and sigma of MQ squared, times H bar omega Q divided by epsilon K minus Q minus epsilon K squared minus H bar omega Q squared times CK prime plus Q sigma dagger CK minus Q sigma dagger CK minus sigma. This is a minus sigma here too. And then CK prime sigma. And these are operators. So what have you done? In some language, you've integrated out the phonons. Phonons are no longer in this problem, except their energies. But there are no phonon operators. So what you've done is remember that picture I showed you of an electron polarizing the lattice around it and then disappearing, and a second electron seeing the polarization and being attracted to the first electron. So in this picture, the lattice has served to cause an effective electron-electron attraction, and that's what this now looks like. This looks like an interaction between two electrons. It's like the Hubbard model up there. And in the case of the Hubbard model, you had some kind of repulsive interaction, and that's basically what this is. But this denominator comes about by considering the phonons explicitly, and what you see about this denominator is it's negative. If these two electron energies are close to one another, and it'll be important that they're near the Fermi surface, if they're close to one another and near the Fermi surface, like close to zero, there's just this minus. This is a negative interaction. Okay, and this is referred to as overscreening. That whole phenomenon there is called overscreening. And so now you have a model that says that because of the phonons, two electrons effectively attract one another. If they have this caveat that these energies are close to one another and close to the Fermi surface. In the end, BCS said that as long as these energies individually, so it's a slightly different statement than having this difference to be smaller than that, as long as they're individually close to the Fermi surface by an amount h bar omega debye, a typical phonon frequency, then you would get attraction. And that's the model we will use when we do BCS theory. Okay, any questions? So this is just setting up the models that we'll use. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow.